It's been 75 years since one great power has been to war with another directly. Now, that is the longest interval in several thousand years. In many countries, popular opinion has finally turned against war as a way of doing business, but almost every nation still keeps an army. And this is according to the man I'll introduce you to now. Gwyn Dyer is an historian and journalist. His new book, The Shortest History of War, joins that serried group of shortest history books. It examines the origins of war and what we need to do to try to abolish this ancient institution, if that's even possible. Gwyn Dyer, it's a great pleasure to welcome you.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Did human beings invent war?
We inherited it. Basically, every human society that we know of, going all the way back, has fought wars. But more significantly, even our nearest relatives, the chimpanzees, fight a kind of war. The tricky bit, which is this: the animals and species like us that fight wars have to be group living. I mean, single, you know, animals that live alone, like old tigers and things like that, don't fight wars. But wolves and lions and other animals that live in groups do compete and do fight each other, because obviously there's always something to fight about. There's always somebody else who will eat the same stuff if you don't get there first. And so there's competition.
Right. Do we know when the first battle, I suppose this is a great definitional issue, between real armies took place then?
That would be around between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago. And again, there's no written history, so we don't know in fine detail. But we do know that by the time of, let's say, Sumeria, which is, you know, Mesopotamia, now Iraq, that the early civilizations there or in the Nile Valley, there was conquest, there were armies, and there were wars involving, battles involving thousands of men, and it was all men at that time.
In fact, you do say in your book that the 13 city-states of Sumer fell into a balance of power system. I didn't realize that that pertained so long ago.
The balance of power occurs because if you have to make alliances, then the possibility always exists that one group will get very much more powerful than another, and that become to dominate all of the other civilizations, city-states, whatever. If that happens and one group starts to get much more powerful, then the alliances will shift and people will move to the other side because you can't afford to allow one group to become all-powerful. So, you know, it's not about whether we like them or not, or whether they're more warlike or not, but if they're more successful at making alliances and it looks like they're going to dominate the whole system, just wait. Because as soon as people realize that's going to happen, enough of them will shift to stop this rising power, to bring it to a halt and restore a balance.
I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, going right through that, I suppose all manner of Britain and France, France and Germany, United States and Britain, they've all been both enemies and allies. So these are very shifting alliances and shifting relationships, aren't they?
They are. Well, it's the thing is that it's, you know, this is not what we tell ourselves it is. We tell ourselves every time that there is some unique reason that the wicked other side has attacked us, because that kind of thing you have to believe in order to do something as dangerous and expensive as fight. But in fact, if you look at it over any longer period of history, we all have been on both sides. And, you know, what's happening is, you know, let's say, you know, take a very recent example. A new great power is rising in the world, and it would have been in the last century and a half, Germany. And automatically, the other great powers will start thinking, uh-oh, they're getting a bit too big for their boots. We had better start taking measures, making alliances so that we can at least match their power. This will be perceived by the Germans, if we want to stay with this example, as everybody ganging up on them. So they will get very defensive in psychological terms, fearing that they are about to be eradicated or, you know, dominated, and they'll start building their alliances. And at some point, then the Archduke gets assassinated in Sarajevo, and that's the trigger, but it's not what it's about.
Look, I think we must talk about the fact that in the 1700s, I think it was, this standing army of soldiers really eventuated. Almost every kingdom in Europe had a standing army. It didn't necessarily, though, make it any easier to go to war. And I was totally intrigued by the fact that you make the point armies could only campaign when there was grass in the fields, because if they had to feed 100,000 men or whatever, with animals as well, they just went through the most enormous amount of food. Now, I had never considered that.
Well, that was one problem, which was that, you know, an army of 100,000 men is going to need at least 40,000 horses in order to pull the guns and pull the bread wagons and all the rest of it. And it will not be able to let its soldiers go out and forage for food, because that involves dispersing them. And then what's going to happen is that a great many of them will disappear, will desert, because the armies of the 16th, 17th, 18th century were not volunteers, patriots, whatever. They were mercenaries, professional soldiers. But, you know, they'll take their pay all the time. And if there's a battle about to happen and you let them go out and forage, they'll just keep going. I mean, who wants to get killed?
Presumably that was one of the things that Napoleon, like, they were certainly far from mercenaries. I mean, if you had an incredible leader like that, a charismatic leader, he really did draw lots of people in who were far from being, and they dragooned them, of course, too, didn't they?
Oh, they did. They conscripted them. But in fact, that was exactly the point where things changed and armies could move much further. They didn't need what they called magazines, you know, sort of places where you store things and you can't get too far from them, because that's, you know, how far can the wagons bring the bread in a day? That's how far you can go. You couldn't go very far, very fast with a mercenary army, because they'll just desert. On the other hand, round about the French Revolution, Napoleon and so on, you suddenly get modern nationalism and people can be motivated, or you might say deceived, into serving voluntarily at the risk of their lives, because it is all for the nation, the motherland, you know, that sort of thing. So, I mean, Napoleon was an extraordinarily charismatic man, but in the 18th century, he couldn't have done that. He needed the French Revolution, he needed French patriotism, enthusiasm, young men wanting to be in the army and serve the country, even lay down their lives. So that's when you get mass armies and we move into the modern era.
Well, look, yes, let's move into the modern era, because apart from the long 19th century gap, the great time after the Napoleonic War, the great powers have gone to war with each other about every 50 years, you note, throughout modern history. And you say, this is what I find very interesting, that's no coincidence. What explains that timing?
Well, if you accept that there is an alliance system in the world and it always evolves because of the balance of power considerations, no rising power must be allowed to dominate all the others, so we'll make alliances to contain it, but eventually that will trigger a war, then those wars involve everybody. I mean, the idea of world wars is much older than 1914. First World War, then the Second World War, 1939-45. Those are the ones that we call world wars because they were very, very big in terms of the damage they did and the number of people they killed and the fact that there were huge armies. But if you actually look at wars in which every great power has been involved, then they come along about every 50 years. And the reason that there is that kind of cycle is because Now you got a system where the wars actually settle everything. So it's no longer one great power against another once in a while, regional. Now we've got a global united system. It's dating from about the 1600s, where, you know, which is basically when Europe expands and takes over the rest of the world. And so there is a single united system. And once that's happened, the world wars settle everything. I mean, all the stakes are on the table and winner takes all. So, you know, at the end of the First World War, all the losing side lose their empires. Now, let history roll on. Some countries are going to do better than others economically. Some populations are going to grow faster than others. The further away you get from that peace settlement, the less the real world of today resembles the world of the end of the last war. And it just happens that the sort of rate at which economies grow, populations grow, and so on, deviate enough to bring about a new situation, unsustainable in terms of the rules laid down at the end of the last war, in an average of around 50 years.
Sure, sure. Now, I'm just thinking that, of course, we've been 70 years since those settlements of World War II, and here we are, and we're very conscious of this in Australia, with this perceived rising tension, you know, whatever it is, between China and the US. So the arrival of a new power, as you say, is one of the reasons that, you know, could tip us back. So, I mean, do you think we can prevent future wars and make sure that we don't fall back into these habits?
I think we can, because the side effect of the system getting more and more powerful, the countries in it becoming better at war with more powerful weapons, doing more damage and destruction, and ending up with extreme peace settlements. I mean, you know, sort of Germany was divided and occupied at the end of the Second World War. That didn't used to happen. At the end of the First World War, all the countries on the losing side lost everything. The side effect of that is that people finally begin to notice that war is not a glorious, the old lies we used to tell ourselves. Well, you know, until the early 1900s, most people in most countries thought that war was a noble and glorious activity. But when you conscript entire populations into war, as we did in both the First and the Second World Wars, when you have weapons that mean that you are not only destroying the other side's soldiers, but their cities, and when eventually you have nuclear weapons, it does get the donkey's attention. This is not a noble activity. It's not even safe. And losing is enormously painful, whereas winning doesn't last. So why are you still playing this game? And I mean, I think there has, in that sense, been a genuine shift in the way we deal with the possibility of war and the kind of values that we judge war by.
However, I mean, I do intend this to be the final part of our discussion, but, you know, the defence budget here in Australia has gone up by 4.1%, which is, you know, infinitely greater than, say, the diplomacy budget. And so, you know, you wonder whether there is still a sort of lingering both appetite for and belief you can't avoid it.
There is. Of course there is. Well, look, you're dealing with just in terms of, you know, our civilized past, about 5,000 years of tradition here in terms of institutions and in terms of thinking. And everybody knows you mustn't use nuclear weapons, for example. And yet we all, or collectively our alliances, all have them. And we do have doctrines that say you must never use them, but I would have thought the simplest way of never using them is not having them. Nobody's gone for that one. So, you know, there is a process underway, I think, in which we are viewing war as in negative ways, desiring not to have wars. I mean, there's no enthusiasm. And so I think it's stupid what we're doing at the moment. And when I say we, I mean the Chinese as well as the Americans and the British and the Australians and everybody else. But we're doing it much more reluctantly and with some hope, I think, that we don't end up at war.
Indeed. Let us hope precisely that. Gwyn Dyer, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.